Good morning. I extend a welcome to all of you today. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. As a meditative piece, this is from, I may not get his name right, Richard Wagamese, a book called Embers, One Ojibwe's Meditations. Unity cannot exist when exclusion is allowed to occur. I was graced with this teaching years ago, when I was working as a traditional elder's helper. The teaching was given in the context of the sacred pipe, but its intention was to help me understand community. What brings us together cannot exist in the same time and place as what keeps us apart. You, me, everyone. My choice is to be aware of our similarities, our yearning for truth, peace, love, belonging, welcome, grace, mercy, a God of our own understanding, and at least one moment of real contact at the heart of every day. Seeing that, I am made more included, extended, and in harmony. Until that moment when I no longer see. I have two readings for you to get us into our topic today. The first comes from a man named Eddie Glaudet. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Eddie Glaudet writes the foreword to the book that I'm going to be speaking about today. It's entitled The Love Battle to Save the Soul of America. He says, we're in a battle for the soul of America, but it is not and has never been simply a political battle. Ours is a moral struggle over who we take ourselves to be and what kind of country we want to live in. The moral question sits at the heart of our troubles today. It has been a central question since the founding of the Republic and the moment of crisis when it felt as if the entire experiment would fall apart. On the eve of the Civil War, in his first inaugural address, President Lincoln understood the moral gravity of the moment. I am loath to close, he said. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely as they will be, by the better angels of our nature. I happened to stumble onto the memorial service for the Reverend Jesse Jackson the other day. And President Obama said these words. We're living in a time when it can be hard to hope. Each day we wake up to some new assault on our democratic institutions, another setback to the idea of the rule of law. An offense to common decency. Every day you wake up to it, to things you just didn't think were possible. Each day we're told by those in high office to fear each other and to turn on each other, and that some Americans count more than others, and that some don't even count at all. Everywhere we see greed and bigotry being celebrated and bullying and mockery masquerading as strength, we see science and expertise denigrated while ignorance and dishonesty and cruelty and corruption are reaping untold rewards. Every single day we see that. And it's hard to hope in those moments. So it may be tempting to get discouraged, to give in to cynicism. It may be tempting for some to compromise with power and grab what you can, or even for good people to maybe just put your head down and wait for the storm to pass. But this man, Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson, inspired us to take the harder path. His voice calls on each of us to be heralds of change, to be messengers of hope, to step forward and say, send me, wherever we have a chance to make an impact, whether it's in our schools, our work, in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, in our cities, not for fame, not for glory, or because success is guaranteed, but because it gives our life purpose, because it aligns with what our faith tells us God demands, and because if we don't step up, no one else will. As I was thinking about this presentation, I was reminded of a New Yorker cartoon I saw some years ago. It was a Thanksgiving table, and Grandma and Grandpa are at the end, and the whole family is there, and the eldest child is standing and saying, Grandma would like to share some things that she's grateful for, and Grandpa would like to get some things off his chest. I'm being Grandpa today, okay? My remarks are based on a book by Jim Wallis called The False White Gospel. I first heard about Jim Wallis when I was in seminary in the early 70s. He too was in seminary at the time at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in the Chicago area. Now, not hard to recall for most of us, many of us, what life was like around here in the early 70s. Rife with issues of justice and peace. Ripe for anyone in seminary who wanted to see real faith in action, which honestly most of us wanted to do. Wallace and several others started a community dedicated to seeing what faith had to say to the Vietnam War and to the civil rights era, among other things. And he called it the Sojourners Community. And he grew up in suburban Detroit and went to a white evangelical church there. He was told by a church elder as a kid that Christianity had nothing to do with racism. Racism was political and faith was personal. That stuck in his craw. He concluded that if the faith of his church had nothing to do with the most pressing issue he had ever confronted that was changing him forever, that he was going to be done with that church. I had a similar experience with my church, but mercifully for me, there were enough voices in it yet speaking truth to power that I remained. But he also wondered why his experience of growing up in Detroit was so very different from the Black experience of growing up in Detroit. And thus began his sojourn. He begins his book with a broad brush. Although he does go back to some early history now and then, most of what occupies him is the here and now. He says this in his introduction. My deepest concerns about our country have come to very dangerous fruition, but at even faster and more furious pace than many of us expected. This is before the war broke out. This now calls for deep and broad levels of resilience and resistance. To undergird and sustain the courage costs of resistance in our lives, we must learn to practice resilience. He says authoritarianism is a theological issue too. Given the realities of human nature, Too much power in the hands of one person unleashes a leader's worst instincts and catalyzes society's worst instincts. Spiritually, every nation has its better angels and worst demons. And an authoritarian leader can mobilize those demons, and has happened in America. The disciplined adherence to checks and balances is more than just a trustworthy political system. It provides the moral equilibrium necessary to prevent the worst and most cruel abuses of power and the accompanying human suffering. Now, the punchline of the book is this. He believes that at the center of all white Christian nationalist ideology and its many expressions is the pervasive racism that has never left our culture. Every aspect of white nationalism that he describes can be traced back to this one evil. He says this, "We are literally in a battle now between false religion and true faith, between racial fascism and multicultural democracy. That fight stems from fear, the motivator of hate, and the threat of violence." Here's his core belief. "I believe that crossing the color line to a genuine multiracial democracy will be the path that finally fulfills America's promise. If communities of faith today won't fight for multiracial democracy in this country, both will fail." Now, Wallace refers to himself as biblically conservative and socially liberal. And I will tell you from speaking from my side of the street, that makes him a rare bird, okay? There just aren't a lot of those guys around. And it leaves him unwelcome more places than not. I will say, though, that I think that trend is shifting as people wake up. He talks at the beginning of his book about about things we could do, and then he talks about why we should do them. And I'm going to reverse those because I'd like to talk about the whys first. Referring back to the church of his upbringing, he believes that one feature of bad religion is to believe that it is essentially personal. As soon as one cites the injunction to love one's neighbor, of course, that whole thing falls apart. He says that without a sense of public discipleship, religion falls easy prey to power brokers promoting a false white gospel. I'm not going to get real churchy here today, so don't worry about that. But here's how he describes the contemporary strategy of white supremacy. He says it's to prevent our changing demography from changing our democracy. It's a commitment to white minority rule by any and all means necessary. Covert and overt voter suppression, racial gerrymandering and reshaping representational political districts, restricting immigration, election denial with electoral corruption, judicial bias, all the way to the Supreme Court, and when all else fails, the promotion of political violence, as January 6th revealed to us, and the threat of all more of all of the above to come, he says. Another quote, "White Christian nationalism doesn't cross lines, it creates them. It seeks to divide us, leading this country down a path that starts with fear, turns to hate, and ultimately leads to violence." January 6, 2021 signaled a failure of politics to find a peaceful resolution to our cultural divide. And he says the elephant in the room is this. We are a nation transitioning away from being a white majority nation to where multiple minorities will be the majority. He calls white supremacy America's original sin, with white supremacist groups the number one terrorist threat to us. He sees this as the greatest threat to our democracy and the threat off of which all others spring. Now, for we who call ourselves Christian, we have to ask ourselves this one essential question. Are we all created in the image of God or not? And for all Americans, the question becomes, are we created equal or not? To both, white Christian nationalists would say, no, we are not. Now, we saw this white nationalism rise during Reconstruction, late 1800s, early 1900s, with the formation of the Klan and all and other such racist groups. Then again in the 1960s. But the truth is, it's always been here and it's never gone away. In other countries, other European countries, where they're trying to cultivate white nationalism, the church has pretty much faded into the background. Our nationalism has that unique, ugly Christian underpinning to it, which makes us different and gives the movement a kind of fuel that it doesn't have other places. But there's a reason for this. When we got here 400 years ago, we saw this land as land ordained for white people. And that the people who were already here must have been of the devil. America was the New Jerusalem. We saw it just like the Israelites, whom God told that they were free to go wipe out the Canaanites over here, and they can go over here and wipe out the Amalekites and take these guys out and take these guys out, because this was chosen land and it was chosen for the chosen people. I'm seeing history rhyme in Israel today with this. Wallace cites a Yale sociologist named Philip Gorski, who says, calls this era a perfect storm of white Christian nationalism. The election of a black president, the emergence of Black Lives Matter movement, the growth of immigration, all have put the racially biased status quo under threat. The result is the emergence of what Gorski calls a more full-throated, vulgar kind of Christian nationalism, which will speak not even in subtle ways about racism and will appeal in not very subtle ways to white grievance, which I think is a key word. Essential to white Christian nationalism is the false belief that we were founded as a Christian nation. Big biblical pieces such as love your neighbor, doing for the least of these, releasing the prisoner, declaring good news to the poor, treating the sojourner as one in our midst, as one of us, necessarily has to get left out of the white false Bible. He says white Christian nationalists are white first and then Christian later on. And today, right-wing Republicans first and then Christian somewhere down the road. Whether spoken or not, there is the sense that we white folks are the chosen people in that ideology. Conversations about slavery or indigenous genocide are now dismissed as critical race theory. We don't want our kids growing up feeling guilty or bad about themselves, after all. He quotes Jeremy Tisby, author of The Color of Compromise, who puts it succinctly, saying that critical race theory is the junk drawer for anything about race and justice that makes a certain kind of person feel uncomfortable. I thought this was fascinating. He says that the Republican Party back in the 1980s went to people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and said, if you turn over your mailing list to us, we will make you household names in America. His conclusion from this startling fact is that religious right did not evolve out of theological discernment or from religious conferences, but from a political takeover by right-wing operatives in the Republican Party. One key development in solidifying the religious right was the defunding of segregated Christian schools like Bob Jones University. He said that abortion only became a religious and political issue later on, once the Republicans realized they weren't going to get very far with racism as their banner. But you could rally people around abortion. Here's a quote. Donald Trump is the culmination of this religious right political strategy, drawing a majority of white evangelicals, while he exemplifies the worst of the immoral, dishonest, unethical, corrupt, and selfish personal and sexual values that would have been anathema in my evangelical home church, he says. So ultimately, another quote, the shift to the right had nothing to do with theological discourse. It was all politics. And he is bold to call the whole movement Antichrist. Now, to flesh out the elephant in the room again a little bit more, it is estimated by 2040, we will no longer be a white majority nation. His words, paranoia is the word that best describes our situation, a very dangerous combination of guns and a complete lack of trust in one another, which is in such radical and horrible contrast to the Good Samaritan parable. Now, he talks a lot about the Good Samaritan parable, which is his essential text for this whole discussion, but I will only mention it. And after that, he goes back to the politics of it all. But he sees a first byproduct and a key component of white Christian nationalist strategy being voting rights. Wallace says this, the battle over voting rights going on right now in America will determine every other issue we care about. Issues like poverty, racial justice, policing and criminal justice, healthcare, human dignity on many fronts, the economy, education, opportunity, access to housing, the meaning of life and family values, liberty and freedom, immigration reform, gun laws, neighborhood safety, national security, and the defining questions of climate change, among others, will all be impacted and even determined by the success or failure of democracy-shaped voting rights. Not surprisingly, in 2021, after the biggest voter turnout in history, lawmakers in 19 states passed 34 different laws, making it harder to vote. I found this story to be quite telling. I'm not sure it fits into the flow very well, but it caught my eye. In the January 6th hearings, it was learned that Mike Pence wouldn't get into the limousine because he didn't trust where the Trump-controlled car was going to take him. In those hearings, Representative Jeremy Raskin quoted your man Thomas Paine as saying, for as in absolute governments the king is law, so in free countries the law ought to be king and there ought be no other. Other factors have spun off of this essential principle of white and male supremacy, our inability to enact sensible gun legislation, a concept he referred to as complementarianism. I had never heard of this, which he defines as the idea that women ought to have roles that complement men rather than holding positions of authority supposedly intended for men. The campaign against wokeism, book banning, curriculum slanting, the general destruction of the truth, all under the umbrella. In other words, white Christian nationalism requires that we find somebody to hate. And they have mastered it like nobody's business. Now, at the heart of this kind of philosophy is a zero-sum worldview that says that something good for my in-group must not benefit the out-group. His words, that is, efforts made to advance the social standing of Black people must not happen at white people's expense. A perspective perfectly illustrated by the knee-jerk infantile reaction of those who responded to the assertion that Black lives matter with, what about white lives? And I believe we've talked about that here, haven't we? So what do we do? Quoting Eddie Glaudet again, we have to rid ourselves once and for all of this belief that white people matter more than others, or we are doomed to repeat the cycles of our ugly history over and over again. And Wallace offers 5 simple steps. The first is find your spiritual groundedness. and your sustenance. We're going to be in this for a while. Defend the vulnerable. Defend the truth. Love your neighbor as yourself, no exceptions. Do what is right and resist what is wrong. His final quote, action is the best antidote to cynicism and despair. I think we've talked about that too, actually. Acting for the common good is the best way to call people out of their tribal silos. Acting together, even across political lines, for things that are good for the community is one way to help overcome polarization. What are you finding to do to resist and to be resilient? Well, Catholics ran the Christian world for 1,500 years. So where I think that began was in 326 AD, when Emperor Constantine had a dream that Jesus said he was going to win a battle on this bridge over here, and he declared the Roman Empire to be Christian, whether you knew it or not. And everything inside the Roman Empire was Christian, and everything outside the Roman Empire was the mission field. And we have been hijacked by politics ever since. That's my simple explanation of it. to me, the most remarkable feature of the Jewish tradition is how they managed to go from 78 AD to 1947, not ever have a land, but still have a people and an identity. I think that's unprecedented in history, and I am forever dazzled by that. Christian biblical literalism is only a product of like the 1900s, 1800s. It's a recent development. We used to argue too, but then somebody said, shut up and just believe what I tell you. And that was easier. I don't know.
Well, as I'll speak, this is a descendant of a Southern family. I think naming stuff or honoring Confederate generals and other people is shameful. We should not do it. It's one thing to have them have a statue somewhere in a museum that nobody looks at. But putting them on pedestals in parks and things like that, we should not have that. As for acknowledging slavery, that is an important part of our history. It's one thing to acknowledge that we had these Southern generals and other people like that and put that in the history. Acknowledging slavery is very important, and saying that's what we did as a country, because in 1775, slavery was legal throughout the British Empire, which meant in all 13 colonies. And it was only gradually in the North that slavery became illegal. And even at the time of the Civil War, several slave states stayed with the Union. So we need to acknowledge this. And, you know, the Germans today don't have statues to Nazis. And we need to have that same attitude toward Confederate generals. We shouldn't have statues to them. When they took Robert E. Lee down and melted the metal, I thought that was great. And my family's from Virginia. And so.
In our town, there's a house where they have a Confederate flag and an American flag up. And I go drive by and say, well, which side are you for? You know, I mean, those were enemies, remember? I'll refer back to a book we talked about some time ago, Wendell Berry, The Hidden Wound, where he talks about the damage done to families that have a history of having owned slaves. that we don't really talk about. From Langston Hughes, I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and I eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll be at the table when the company comes. Nobody will dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too am America.